Direct from the web, it's Billy Masters Live. And now, please welcome your host,
who?
Billy Masters.
Oh, my God. Showtime. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Billy Masters Live. I am, of course, your host, Billy Masters. It's been a while. I'm just trying to find my right angle. Oh, I don't know. I kind of like sitting like this, like a little intimate, asking you over for coffee. How are you? Today, thank you, Monica. Today is Thursday, October 13th, 2022. We've been away for a while. So here's what happened. I wanted to take the summer off. You know, I thought that was going to be a much longer story. That's it. I just wanted the summer off. And as you could see, like, I got really, like, beach hair. I'm in Florida. For those of you who watch the show regularly, oh, God, it's flying everywhere. For those of you who watch the show regularly, this is the Fort Lauderdale Beach House. And I was sitting back on the beach, and I thought to myself, let's do a show. And who did I want to have on the show? And I thought to myself, oh, you know, there's nobody I really want to talk to. But then I thought, you know, there's somebody that I'd been putting aside talking to. And it's my friend James Gavin, who wrote this fantastic book, which I can't somehow show the still from. There it is. Okay. George Michael, A Life. Hello. It's a fantastic book, and it's been out. James, show me with fingers. How many months has it been out? Eight? Or three? All right, just three. It's an awfully long finger. All right, well, we'll talk about that later. So anyway, we had talked about doing something before the summer. And then I said, oh, I'll get to it. And then, well, clearly I didn't. And of course, I want to catch up on gossip of what, first off, the thing I miss about not doing the show is I don't have people to just kibitz with, to just say, what did you think of this? And, oh, girl, what did you think of that? And so I said, you know, I need an ooh girl guest. And so Michael Musto is here. And fun fact, our second to last show before we went on hiatus was our Tony Awards show. And Michael was one of the guests. And by the way, Michael, I don't know if you know this, like over 6,000 people have watched that show. I mean, it was one of the most fun shows we had done. And so I was really glad I did it. Anyway, but I was going to talk about something else as the monologue, but this is probably too much information. If you're not interested in Billy Masters' sex life, you can skip through this. It'll only take a minute or two. So last night I was reading over James' book, which I'd already read once, but I wanted to take notes. And, in the background, all of a sudden, I hear a beep from my phone, and it was that familiar beep of Grindr. It's like the siren's call. I heard it and said, oh, well, whatever. I ignored it. And then there was a second beep, and I'm like, two beeps. So it was this guy. Now, I've got his profile. Now, it's not going to show his face or anything, but look at this. Okay. Oh, no, that's George Michael. It wasn't George Michael. My God, wouldn't it have been great if it were George Michael back from the dead? Okay, where is the... Oh, my God, maybe it's not here. Oh, Monica, did you not put it up here? No, she might not have. Well, anyway, the thing said that he was looking for somebody 45 plus. And I said, oh, well, that's good. And he said, not interested in looks. And I thought, well, that's kind of good and bad because, you know, I have some looks. But he's not interested, so who's going to turn me down? Although it did occur to me, what if I was turned down by somebody who's not interested in looks? What does that say about me? But then the worst, he said, looking for well-hung chubby. Chubby. And I thought to myself, well, I'm not chubby. But I thought to myself, wouldn't it be nice to have sex with somebody where I didn't have to inhale the entire time? So this is the guy. Now, I'm only showing him from the back. Okay, but that's a good back. You know, the front was good too. So anyway, we're chatting back and forth, back and forth. Here's what he sent to me. I swear to God, this has not been edited in any way. You have a nice smile. teeth? Sorry for this question. It's just important to me because I like to kiss. Well, he's interested in 45 plus. My hunch is he has been with people with no teeth. And I thought, can I be with somebody who's asking if I have my own teeth? So anyway, I turned him down. That's the story. I mean, it doesn't really go anywhere, but I just thought it was an interesting little anecdote from the sex life of Billy Masters, which, by the way, is how most of these sex stories go these days. Although the weekend looms. Anyway, okay, as I said, my first guest, he is a legend. There are very few legends in the world. And I've said this before, I'd say it again. Without people like Michael Musto, there would be no Billy Masters. So he gets the blame. I grew up reading The Village Voice. We, in my little hometown of Medford, Massachusetts, we had a smoke shop that used to get The Village Voice. I think they got like one copy for me. And I used to read it, and I used to live for everything Michael Musto said. And the idea that I would be friends with him was just, I don't know, just too much for me to even fathom. But not only is he a friend, he's here. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Michael Musto.
Hi, Billy. I'm happy to be your old girl guest.
You are my old girl.
And I didn't realize I gave birth to you, basically. I had no idea.
You did. You know, there were people, because if you lived in a suburb that... If you lived in the suburb, not in like a main metropolitan area, there wasn't a lot of gay context, 70s, even 80s. And I remember, I told Ronnie Larson this, when I saw Making Porn on Donahue, I said, oh, there are gay plays like this? So there you go. I was really aiming low. But then, you know, you were like the voice, you had the life that somebody who was a little gay boy in the suburb really wanted. And I'm always curious to ask you, was the life for you as much fun as it seemed?
I can never really relax and have fun. I've maybe been happy like 3 seconds out of my entire life. But of all possible lives, the one that I've had has been the best one. And yeah, it was fun. Though there were horrible things happening, you know, in the 80s when clubs were extraordinary. AIDS was mounting. So you really could not sort of relax for a second. There was always a kind of activism underlying whatever hedonism we were going after. And that's one reason. I know we're going to talk about Bros, the Billy Eichner.
Yeah, sure.
One thing I really liked about it is it's not just a gay rom-com. It's not just a soft around the edges, happy-go-lucky romance. It has an activist spirit because Billy Eichner's character is an activist. He's fed up with Hollywood casting straight actors in gay roles in these doom-laden movies that the masses eat up. And then the straight actors always win awards for their alleged courage. And the Billy character is also mad at always being told to go back in the closet. Tone it down. Could you just tone it down? And I love that that's the beating spirit of this movie almost as much as the romance itself. I'm not happy that it flopped.
Well, and that's my question. Do you and I agree with everything you said. Do you think that that type of character and that kind of focus helped or hurt a rom-com, forgetting about whether it's gay or not?
Well, I hate now joining the masses of the Monday morning quarterbacks who are going to say why it failed. But I think I'm fairly more knowledgeable than most of the people doing so. So I don't mind putting in my 2 cents. I think one of the problems is they should have built the movie, started slow and built it, but they opened in over 3,000 theaters.
Right.
I think they should have also streamed it. And, you know, there's a lot of queer content already streaming that people can access. Things like Uncoupled with Neil Patrick Harris, which is about a slightly older age group, but still it's out there. So this isn't totally revolutionary. And also the way they marketed it, I have to agree with certain people. It was marketed as this is good for you. This movie is good for you and you better go support it. And nobody goes to a movie for that reason.
It's historic. As Harvey said, is this a history lesson or a movie?
Yeah. And it's like, this is the first queer rom-com. Well, and then people started saying, what about In-N-Out? And then they would say,
Trick was a very good example because I really think people have forgotten about Trick. And again, it wasn't wide, but it was a gay rom-com that was just fun.
Right. And then people said, what about In-N-Out? And then they had to sort of tweak the claim of first rom-com and say, well, the first big budget Hollywood rom-com, and then they had to add with an all queer cast, and then they had to add except for straight celebrities cameoing as themselves like Deborah Messing and Kristen Chenoweth. So right. It became more and more disclaimers as to what of a first this was.
Yes, Stuart Rhode had the worst marketing campaign ever. Agreed. I don't know ever.
Billy Eichner last year announced, I'm doing the world's first gay rom-com. So right. It's hard for him to now complain about that. That's the way he billed it. And I was thrilled about it. I messaged him right away. I said, congrats, can I interview you? And he said, well, but, you know, let's do it when it comes out, which I haven't done yet. But in any case, I do agree with Billy that there's homophobia out there and straight people are not going to go, hey, honey, there's the first queer rom-com. Let's go. Why would they? You know, these are the same people who when Brokeback Mountain was up for the Oscar, they wouldn't even look at the screeners. That's why Brokeback didn't win Best Picture, remember?
Right.
Some of the voters wouldn't even look at the screeners because they're squeamish about queer sex.
But I will say I agree with you about streaming, is that I think that it will do huge business in streaming. I think wives will put it on and husbands will watch it and enjoy it. And I think that because Billy made that kind of snarky comment about it's not some little shitty disposable streaming piece of crap, that he kind of set himself up for the reviews to write themselves, that had it started streaming and smaller, it would have picked up momentum.
It's condescending of him to say that because people know now the quality has shifted to streaming and television. That's where the really great stuff is. I have to say, much as I hate to say this, Billy did a great job, but he's not yet what you would call an A-list movie star. I think that was part of the problem.
And neither is Luke, which is, again, your issue. Somebody who is... notable said to me that, and he asked I not name him, he said for a rom-com to succeed, leads either have to be famous, a lead has to be famous, fuckable, or likable. And Billy is none of those things. And I don't mean that as a negative thing,
because
somebody would say, well, I think somebody wouldn't say I'm fuckable, but they might say I'm cute. Billy has built his brand on being abrasive, not
right, but he's playing an abrasive character who thinks he will never find love, but he finds someone. And to say he's not likable, that's what he's playing. He's playing someone who just won't settle down, won't calm down.
I don't know if audiences enjoy that, seeing that in a rom-com. They'll take crotchety, but not abrasive, I think. But I could be wrong.
These are all factors, and it's easy for us to say now. I thought the movie was a hit. And to be a hit, like you say, it'll probably do well on streaming, but it's going to have to make over $70 million, I think, to break even, because it costs 30 some odd. And then there's the marketing, which is 30 to 40.
Yeah.
There's a lot of money spent on marketing. One thing Billy said, which is a factor, which is that some theaters wouldn't even show the trailers because they're homophobic. True. That's another example of how homophobia helps us sink this movie. But... in general, it's really hard to berate people for not going to a movie. It's not their job to see your movie.
Right. And you can't also get them by kind of threatening them.
No.
If you don't go, you're a homophobic piece of shit. I'm like, oh, Jesus.
Yeah, it's like, well, sorry, I don't want to see it. But let me give him credit for something else because I keep going up and down, up and down. Not only did he cast queers as queers, but in the straight role of the mother of Luke McFarlane, he cast Amanda Beers, the out lesbian from Married with Children. So he's saying, I love what Billy's saying with this movie. He's making a statement. Why can't queers play queers? And why can't queers play straights? And so many of the people in this movie don't get the breaks elsewhere. But again, people aren't going to pay to see something. Let's go see people get a break. And by the way, Amanda Beers, when Amanda Beers came out, she suddenly later became a director. You do the math. She told me it was not because of the homophobia. She told me she wanted to direct. I think she's being nice. And obviously she did want to act because she took this role.
Yeah, I think the flip side of that, just because I have to always go be the devil's advocate, is that if Billy is saying that gays can play straights, then you also cannot argue that straights can't play gays.
No, and he's not saying that straight.
He doesn't say that. Right. No,
he's simply saying, I am going to give queers
everybody a chance
that they are denied. He's not saying there has to be a law that queers have to play queers any more than Bill Cosby, who's the worst example I can think of, when he hired all black people on the Cosby show. I'm not endorsing anything else Bill Cosby has done. But he was pretty much saying, I'm giving people a break who don't get a break.
Okay, Gio says, what about another gay movie and another gay sequel? I don't know if we can put those in the same category.
That's not really
they didn't have theatrical release, I don't think.
Not what we call a big budget Hollywood movie, no.
Let's see, what else? Say something about Boys in the Band, the original and the remake, with all gays in the cast. Well, that's a good example of, it added another layer to it because you knew the whole cast actually was gay. And well, I don't know how much it made it.
The original cast was mostly.
Mostly.
Because they were in the closet because at that
But not openly.
Right, because who was openly gay at that point in the 60s? Very few people. But the point is, as closet gays, a lot of them did even better than the new group of actors because they were mirroring the world of gays,
lives.
Which was we're out amongst each other, but not in the outside world. They were brilliant. Some of them were straight. I mean, Cliff Gorman was straight, Lawrence Luckenbill.
Lawrence, right.
Now
somebody else just wrote, you really can't call Boys in the Band a rom-com.
No, it really isn't, unless you count The Cowboy and Harold. A beautiful love story.
Oh, Howard says The Ritz. Well, The Ritz wasn't a gay movie. It's a farce.
It's a screwball comedy about
set in a bathhouse.
Yeah, it's not a romantic comedy. I mean, Billy is saying, why can't we have the same tropes, the same genres as the straights? I'm totally behind him. And guess what, Billy? The movie got raves. And also, when they had test screenings, they're not stupid. They didn't just throw it out there. Everyone at the test screening pretty much said, love it. Thumbs up. It was then, but the problem was then getting people to go and pay.
Yeah, I also think, well, I think you're right. That's a very good point, is what you might enjoy and what you might go out and buy a ticket for are two different things. But I also think that there is a little bit of, you know, if we don't like this movie or say or criticize it in any way, we're coming off as homophobic, which neither of us, any of our caveats are not homophobic. It's about the film or the marketing or the approach, whatever. Yes.
And you know what? When I saw it at a screening, I wrote a rave on Facebook and I'll stand by it. Just because it flopped at the box office doesn't change my estimation. It's funny. It's activist. It includes so many members of the community. It spoofs the community itself. And Deborah Messing, to give credit to a straight person, she's hilarious as herself.
Yeah, she's great. Am I the only one that thinks the whole movie was made so that Billy Eichner could kiss Luke McFarlane?
Well, I mean, let's go back to let's go back to Torch Song Trilogy where Harvey.
Yeah, that's a good example too, right?
Look, if you're
does
writing
that bother you?
If I was writing a rom com for myself, yeah. I would be kissing not a troll. Let's put it that way.
You and I were talking before the show, and you told me that you're getting out more. I'm so glad. How long was it that you hadn't gone to like a show?
Well, ever since they had theater lockdown, mm-hmm. and then they had a mask mandate when they reopened on Broadway. I can't wear a mask because I start seizuring and it'll distract from the show. If you see me spazzing in the audience, I don't think that would be pretty. So I had to wait till they lifted the mask mandate. And now I've seen three plays that I liked a lot. One is Leopoldstadt by Tom Stoppard, which mm-hmm. is over 50 years in the life of an extended Viennese Jewish family. Mm-hmm. Then I saw 1776, which I also liked a lot. And that's a gender switch. There are no males.
All women.
Women
started in Boston at the Cambridge at the ART. Diane Paulus, who did Pippin and something else.
Oh, she's Hair. She did Hair.
Yeah, right. And yes, you liked it?
You co-directed. I liked it a lot. I thought the cast was incredible. There was no weak link.
It's a flawed show, don't you think?
I always loved the show. I'm sorry. And I love
really?
The
okay.
I love the movie.
All right. And what else did you see?
The more to me, it's very resonant about today because you see the obstinate conservatives who are standing in the way of progress and you have to make concessions to sort of get them to come on board. Because at the very last minute, they had to cut a condemnation of slavery out of the Declaration of Independence or the conservatives wouldn't have signed it.
Wouldn't have signed, right. Now, right. And isn't that interesting when you think that they're having the same discussions they had over 200
Nothing
years ago?
Nothing has changed. Nothing. Except right. Now they try to attack the Capitol and kill people and overthrow an honest election. And
I think they tried to do it then.
No, but they equate that with the Revolutionary War, which is a whole other
thing. Oh, yeah.
That was for freedom. This is the opposite of freedom. And then the third show I saw was Death of a Salesman, which also does a switch whereby the Lohman family is African-American It's Wendell Pierce as Willie Loman, Sharon D. Clarke as Linda.
Oh, who's so fantastic, isn't she? How is she in the role?
That's good. And they cast whites as most of the other characters, which works because his boss now takes on a whole other racial dimension.
Oh, that would be very interesting.
And also Willie's mistress is white, which makes it even more dangerous because in 1949, there were not a lot of interracial things that were permitted. No. Or endorsed. So it may, I just thought the changes worked, and Wendell Pierce was tremendous.
And these are any of these, I know something is a limited run. Is it Death that's announced as a limited run?
Some of them turn out to be limited without wanting to be. When the reviews come out.
Well, you know, that's how life goes.
My whole life is a limited run. Except it seems to
shut up. No, you
were getting a lot of extensions.
You're back at the Village Voice. Is the Village Voice now, who owns it? Is it back with people that were involved before? Is it completely new?
No.
What is happening?
It's owned by Brian Calais, who owns LA Weekly. He's LA.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And he has entrusted it to just be the Village Voice. He just wants it to be what it is, a liberal paper that celebrates the underdog and celebrates the arts. And Bob Baker, who is from the old Village Voice, is doing the editing and the assigning. And Bob's wife, Laura Bell, is also helping with editing. And it's great because it's very Village Voice-y. And I get to not only do theater reviews, but I do think pieces. I did a God to Fire Island from A to Z. I'll do service pieces, you name it.
Cool. Isn't it funny how life comes full circle?
It's so weird. I mean, I grew up where nothing ever changed because I was an only child. We never had another kid come along. We never moved. When we got aluminum siding on the house, it was a big deal. And once we drove up, there's going to be a psychological reason for this backstory here. We drove upstate once to go to some reservation, / theme park, and we came back because it was drizzling. So what I'm saying is I became fetishizing of normalcy and stabilization, stasis. I'm afraid of change.
Oh, so you like that.
So I like that the Village Voice is in my DNA my entire adult life. My first article I found it recently was 1981 on the Village Voice.
Wow.
My column, La Dolce Musto, started in 84. I was laid off in 2013. Then they brought me back with a new owner, new editor. Then it folded. Then Brian Kelly bought it, brought it back. Now I'm back. And it's like Glenn Close at the end of Fatal Attraction. It keeps bouncing out of the bathtub.
Eventually, you're going to own it.
You know, it really could end up that way.
End up that way. What else is going on for you? Now, do you feel, because I'm hearing sirens, so New York is
back.
They're
coming at me. It's back. Yeah, the sirens are back.
When you're out.
To me, it's a disco. Ooh.
I know. Well, it's like being in a gay bar. Back at Limelight.
The last time I went to, my mother used to say, have you been to church lately? And I said, yes, I went to Limelight last night.
Do you feel that New York is back?
I never felt it went away when Trump was calling it a ghost town. It was not a ghost town. It was, even with COVID.
No, but I'm talking about since the pandemic, where it was really, it was scary, I thought. Because
no, but I'm saying even then it wasn't scary. It was, that was overhyped in the media and Trump said it was a ghost town. It was not. If people leave, fine. It's the same wusses that left after 9/11. Good riddance. Goodbye, Felicia. It's like Tulsi Gabbard leaving the Democratic Party. Bye-bye. You don't belong here. But New York is always going to be the place. It's always number one. It's the focal point for the culture, for the excitement, for the diversity.
Are the tourists all coming back? Is the theater doing better? Because we talked in the spring how it was slowly getting back. And again, the mask mandate was still there. So how is it now?
It's not up to the levels of pre-COVID, but it's getting there. And I do see a lot of tourists, you know, and I don't run them over on my bike. I'm very nice. I just throw things. No, we need the tourism. I'm mature now, and I realize that we should welcome them because they do pump money into our society.
Oh, Michael, I love talking to you. I could talk to you forever, but I've got to go to James. Michael, let's do another panel. Let's do another round table and get some of the people back from the last time because we had so much fun. We'll do it maybe at the end of the year. We can look back on the year.
Oh, let's do that. Yeah.
All right, we will. Put it on your calendar.
It was a good
This was a year to look back on.
It was. And it's just
and it will be interesting to see where Bros is in December.
Yeah, because I hope it shows everyone wrong and I hope they make a fortune.
I do hope so. And again, I want to just underline the fact, I think Billy Eichner is wildly talented. And I'm so glad he got this chance to do this movie. And I hope he gets a chance to do so many more. He wants to do a Paul Lynde biopic and something else. I know he's announced too. That he
when I said he's not a movie star, what I meant is he's best known for TV. And he did the voice in Lion King. Remember Lion King?
Oh, that's true. He did do that. I forget that.
Right, but as far as himself being a male leading man, he's on the way here with this. But look, this is progress. What, no matter how people excavate the corpse of the movie, what he did.
Oh wait, before I let you go, we have an email question from Richard Zimmerman. Did you see Leah in Funny Girl? Let's talk Funny Girl quickly. Did you see anybody in Funny Girl?
During the mask mandate is when they had Beanie Feldstein, so I missed all of that.
Oh.
I'm not personally a fan of Lea Michele. I heard she's tremendous. She got raves.
Yep, that's what I hear.
I don't want to go. I don't care. And they don't really invite me for the replacement cast. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So yep. It isn't a Sophie's Choice where I have to wonder if I want to go. I'm just not going. But for those who are enjoying her, they're saying that she brings a musicality, obviously. And Charles McNulty, a friend of mine, is the critic for the LA Times. He said it's one of the 5 best musical theater performances he's ever seen.
And good for, again, I'm not a fan of hers either, but if she's good, good for her. I want to see her because if she's good, I'll be the judge.
Well, and we miss Angela.
Maybe.
So we need
Angie.
We need new musical divas.
Oh, can I just, I'm going to just tell a very quick Angela Lansbury story. So you remember Rick McKay, who did Broadway Behind the Golden Age documentary. He was staying at my house in Los Angeles when he was interviewing everyone in LA. He went to Angela's house and she wasn't home. He rang the bell, wasn't home. So he went back out to his car. He sat in the car and she came home. She pulled in with her car and came out with some groceries and a big thing of flowers. So he waited like 5-10 minutes before he rang the bell again, because let her put her groceries away. He rang the bell and she came to the door with gardening gloves and clippers. She said, oh, sorry, I didn't hear you. And she led him into, I must have been in the backyard. I just cut all these beautiful flowers. And she was arranging them.
She was doing a Melania Trump.
God love her. Garden. It was just fantastic.
Well, I hear she talks like a truck driver, which I love because everyone thinks her as Mrs. Potts and just so delightful. She talked like a truck driver, which makes me love her even more.
Yeah, I think, was it Julie Andrews who said that she told the most nasty stories?
So something about Sondheim, something risque about Sondheim and a young man.
Well, we'll leave it at that. Michael, thank you for being on the show.
Bye, Charlie. Talk to you soon.
Hi, sweetheart. Oh, my God, I love him. But now, shifting gears, we are now going, we've got all sorts of texts. People, leave your messages there. And, okay, here's what we don't do all the time. If you have a question for James, text it here and we'll bring it up. And if you want to go on camera, we might bring you on. How do you like that? Michael, you're still there. Michael? You still there?
Hi, honey.
I just ask you because James asked me, do you have a George Michael story? Had you ever met him?
Well, I went into a bathroom once. No, I'm kidding. I honestly don't, except one night he was at the Limelight. And he knew that everyone in the place wanted to descend on him. Right. And what he did was he talked to the DJ in the chapel area and focused on that DJ and had a conversation for a long time. Pretty much shutting out everyone else. So everyone else could kind of just stand back and leave him alone. And he was really talking music to a music professional. I saw Betty Davis do the same thing where I was sitting at her table at a group dinner. And she
at Limelight.
No, this was Plato's Retreat. And she, the Anvil. And no, I'm kidding. It was a Disney dinner, a fancy Disney. And Betty focused on a younger actress who was asking her questions. And Betty totally zoomed in. She gave her that total... I hear Kim Novak does that too. She did that to Charles Bush on one of those TCM cruises where she zoomed in with her eyes and there was a mob wanting to talk to her. And her publicist was even, oh, Kim, your friends. And she's like, I'm talking to Charles. And that was the ability that George Michael had to focus. And I think it was a self-preservation thing. It's a shame he'll be remembered mainly for his bath romantics because his music was really quite wonderful.
I'm just going to, just so that James can say hi. And, you know, this way I get a picture of the three of us. So there you go. James, do you have any questions for Michael? Or vice versa?
James, what was the biggest revelation in your book? What was the biggest thing that people didn't know about George Michael that you uncovered?
One nice thing that you know all about is that George Michael had a huge heart and that he was one of the great philanthropists of pop music. George Michael did not do philanthropy. And by the way, he gave away millions of pounds to pet causes of his, especially Project Angel Food, but he didn't do it for the press release. He didn't do it and then call his publicist and ask that his publicist get in touch with someone like you so that you could print it. He was annoyed when word came out of these kind acts that he did. He did them for friends of his who were messed up on drugs. He did them for strangers
James, wasn't there a story of a girl who was trying to get off drugs that he saw on TV and he tracked her down and sent an anonymous check or something?
There were various stories like that. He sat in his later years, he was in front of the television set a lot, and he watched shows, afternoon shows like that, that portrayed people in trouble and what was being done about it. And George got on the phone and said, "This is George Michael." And he got that contact info and he wrote checks and sent them out, which is such a beautiful thing. And he didn't want to take bows for it. He just wanted to help. I think that part of the reason why he focused on that so much in his later years is that his music career had gone off the rails. And I think that this gave him a real sense of worth.
Mm-hmm. So he did it for himself in a way?
Maybe it made him feel good.
Mother Teresa said she did stuff to make herself feel good. She admitted that. But James, before I disappear, let me ask you one more quickie, which is, when George Michael duetted with Aretha Franklin, was he daunted or intimidated in any way?
In that took place in 1980, in the late 80s, just in between Wham and Faith, his first big solo album. And in the studio, he was so freaked out by being with the Queen of Soul, who had given him this royal consecration by letting this white British blue-eyed soul singer sing with her. He was seeing her in action, freaked him out, and he did say to his manager, Rob Kahane, "Get me out of here. I can't do this." He stayed, as you know.
I'm surprised they're actually in the same studio because so many duets are recorded separately.
Yeah, I think Annie Lennox and Aretha were in different studios.
The video is different studios.
And then in the video, they're together. They're shown together, as he was with Whitney when he made, many years later, a video with Whitney. And there they are in the studio together. It was rare at that time for both big stars who were doing a duet, a video based on a record that they had never met to record, as you know. And there they both were together, George and Whitney. That's a whole other story. He didn't like her very much, as a matter of fact. He wasn't that big a Whitney Houston fan. And she was such a mess at the time that they were working together that he was thoroughly frustrated by her behavior. As always, however, he behaved like a gentleman. George was a well-brought-up boy. He was polite to people.
I want queers to love each other.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
Bye, guys. Thank you.
Bye,
James.
So good to see your face.
Hi, James. How are you?
I am better than ever. And while you and I and Michael were talking about Broadway, I was flashing back to an early moment in our friendship, June of 2015, when you invited me to the first and only Broadway opening night that I have ever witnessed.
And you had that sexy suit on, that vintage suit that I loved.
And you were looking incredibly sharp. You outshone me at every step of the way. And you and everyone was buzzing around you. And we were up in the balcony, best seats in the house, watching Head Over Heels.
Head Over Heels, the Go-Go's musical,
Now, I just ran into, in September on Fire Island, I ran into one of the producers, my friend Jeff Wilson. who was there that night, of course. And I told Jeff this story. I said that in between acts, during the intermission,
I know what story you're going to tell. So go ahead.
I grabbed her arm and I said, "This is fabulous. This is going to run forever." Yeah. So, and I believed it until we got to the sumptuous party afterwards that you took me to, and that's where I ran into Jeff and I said, "Jeff, congratulations. This is going to be a triumph." And his face fell and he said, "The reviews are terrible." Broke my heart, but it shows you how much I know. Broadway.
Well, but I felt the same way because I remember I was talking because we had taken some photos with some of the Go-Go's and people were whispering in each other's ears and the girls were actually crying. Two of them started sobbing and left. And it was a heartbreaking night, which is so funny because it had been so up. And I've heard that buzz of reviews can clear out a party on opening night. I've never seen it until then. We left relatively early as well, but I think I was driving back to Boston that night.
You were. But yeah. I think we were right and the critics were wrong. I look back and I still think that was a fabulously hip show. How often do you see
and fun?
And I loved the juxtaposition of the Elizabethan humor and drama and the Go-Go's songs cutting back and forth between the two of those things, I thought was hilarious and so cool. And much more recently, as you know, I guess it was earlier this year, Lea Delaria did it in Los Angeles.
Pasadena, yeah.
Yeah, I heard she was great, needless to say.
Yes, she was. I didn't see her either. But now, it's funny. With George Michael, with such a catalog, have there been discussions about some sort of a jukebox musical utilizing his music, or does the family not want to go that route?
I was a few months back at a birthday party in West Barrington, Massachusetts, for my friend, Bobby Miller, the great photographer, Bobby Miller. And one of the guests there, I wish I remembered his name, was a producer. And he said, it's happening. We've been working on this for 10 years and we've gotten the okay. And I haven't heard anything about it since. You know how those announcements go. People talk about a big project that may still be imaginary. I would like to see it happen in the same way that I'd like to see a biopic happen, but it's all pie in the sky until the deal is on the table.
Absolutely. After your book came, not after it came out, but certainly around the same time, that documentary came out.
It did.
And was there anything that you saw in the documentary, I'm assuming you saw it, that you said, "Oh, I wish I knew that and could put it in the book or could have talked to that person"? Because that was a more or less sanctioned documentary, correct?
Well, that was a director's cut of a film that had come out a few months after George died. So it came out in the first half of 2017. They added some bells and whistles to it, some extra archival footage and some new interviews. But I had seen the original and I didn't think that it was insightful or truthful about George, but I thought that some of the archival footage really touched my heart. And what I wish that I had maybe shown an even brighter light on was the fact that all that home movie footage of George and Anselmo, the love of his life, taken, I presume, during the six-month window in which they met in 1991, they met in Rio, and George for 6 months was so happy. I was so struck by what Michael said about having been happy 3 seconds in his entire life. That was the George Michael story. George was so beset with he was always carrying around such a heavy burden. And there he is, Bingo. There he is with this beautiful man. And he had found the love that he thought that he would never find. And
goofy. I mean, he was not a goofy person.
No, but
he's playing.
Frolicking in the pool and radiating happiness. And then 6 months into that relationship, Anselmo got the news that he was HIV positive. and Anselmo lived for one more year after that, but it was a fraught with, on George's part, fraught with anger and fear and a sense that this angel from on high was being snatched away from him and that the gods really had it out for him.
Well, I'm we've talked about this. I'm Albanian. He was Greek. So there, we are steeped in this fatalistic kind of view of life, of that the gods are tormenting us. And we have the highs and lows of that. It seemed like he was always that person. You know, he reached for the sky, the stars in an Icarus kind of way, or sun in that case, and then would crash. There were highs and lows in his life always. But I don't remember really in your book hearing about those kind of mood swings when he was younger. He was somewhat quiet and sullen as a child.
He was, imagine being 7, 8, 9 years old and knowing that you're different and knowing that everybody around you, including your, from your father to the kids at school, to the people who wrote tabloid headlines in the Sun, that they all disapprove of you. And, and they think that this is bad and wrong and must be kept secret. And then on a similar track going at the same time was the fact that he wanted to conquer the world. He wanted to be a superstar. And that made the risks involved in being truthful about who he was 100 times heavier. So George, it's interesting, isn't it, with superstars, the thing, the emptiness or the demons inside them that drive them to get where they go very often are the same things that wind up tearing it all down. And that is very much the George Michael story.
Well, like you said, I mean, that is a story we've seen so many times. And to become that driven, you have to have, I hate to generalize, but you typically have to be feeding some sort of a hole in your life to be that driven. Because if you're happy in other ways, you don't need to be that driven. You've got other things. This was his life. And, you know, one of the things I love about your book is that you really do something that most people haven't done, which is you do not minimize the contribution of Andrew Ridgeley to Wham. People often bring up, you know, what did he do? He barely played the guitar. He didn't sing. He just walked around on stage wearing fabulous clothes. And you have said that without Andrew Ridgeley, there very well may not have been a George Michael or a Wham, because while he had this need, he did need somebody to spur him on and push him and give him confidence. And later in his life, he may have still had the talent, but he didn't have that person who was his champion. And he did have that for, you know, 10, 15 years with Andrew Ridgeley from the time they were in school till the time they broke up and thereafter. I mean, people don't understand. Andrew was with him till the end of his life.
That's all spot on what you said about their relationship and Andrew's importance. Andrew Ridgeley was the template of coolness for this pudgy nerd, pudgy, pimply nerd with glasses and wild curly hair who hated what he
saw. Wasn't that pudgy. Granted, this picture, he's really young. That's him next to his father. But he was a cute kid. Where did he have this image of being fat? Pimply, I understand.
He had this image because it had been drummed. He had been belittled so much at home by his very intimidating father, belittled not only because he was the nerd that he was, but because he had these musical ambitions that his father dismissed as ridiculous. George was, it's again, so many superstars follow the same general journey in which I'll show you becomes the big motivating force. And then problems set in as a result of that. But George, very poignantly, in my opinion, said that the Wham period, the early Wham period, was by far the happiest he ever was at show business. It was still a lark at that time. It was a game. It was a challenge. The stakes were not so high. And also, people were not nipping at his heels to have him expose his sex life. George was incapable of saying the words "I am gay" publicly until he was forced to do so through most unfortunate circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's funny that we were talking about the Go-Go's earlier, because the Go-Go's have often said before they got their record contract was the happiest time of the band, because again, you're finding your way. The stakes are not high. People, and with success comes the necessity to top it or to give in to critics who are waiting for you to fail. And so, I mean, again, it's a story as old as time.
Do you think Barbara Streisand has ever been happy? I don't see it.
No.
I don't see a glimmer of it in anything she does. Now 80 years old, she's still getting pissed off about people mispronouncing her name.
Right.
And ancient bad reviews that she got at the beginning of her career. Those things that drove her to create Barbara Streisand, but that are eating away at her 60 years later. It's astonishing to me when I watch her interviewed.
Well, again, it's very similar to what you said about George Michael. She was unattractive, although that's debatable. Her mother would say, "Oh, Barbara's the singer, but here's my pretty daughter." And it was her sister. And, you know, as I said in the Bros review, you know, it's something innate in people. If you're funny, you want to be beautiful. If you've got straight hair, you want curly hair. You know, we all are missing something. It's just a question of to what degree. And Barbara threw that into her career with her talent, which is wonderful, but how healthy that is, I don't know. I mean, we look at, this is just such a sad picture. I hate to even show it, but this is one of the last pictures of George Michael taken. He is, first off, the fact that he went out in public at a restaurant like this is so shocking to me.
Yeah.
And you could see that this isn't somebody who's healthy or going to last much longer. And there's somebody who had been this.
Yeah.
You know, the epitome of male beauty and sexuality. And I very often say that, you know, people like Marilyn Monroe and James Dean, they were somewhat fortunate to die in their prime because they are forever that person.
Billy, it's all the more ironic that George ventured out with his last boyfriend, Foddy, to this neighborhood Italian restaurant filled with people. Appeared in public like that. Everybody knew it was George Michael. That's a cell phone picture taken from another table. George was so obsessively self-critical of the way he looked, so unhappy again with what he saw in the mirror, that he would often buy the rights up to entire photo shoots that had been done of him. That's why it was so hard for me to find the, in my opinion, perfect picture that I found for the cover of my book, which is from the I'm Your Man Wham video shoot of 1985. And you see that face could be on a coin. That is Dionysian. Right. And the eyes reveal everything. I love that picture, but finding that picture, I found it at the 11th hour because nothing else that I wanted was available. That's why certain videos that he shot, like Careless Whisper, were so drawn out and expensive. The entire Wham in China documentary, which he insisted had to be largely reshot because he hated the way he looked. Imagine.
Yeah, let's go back.
Yeah.
We have to go back to the Careless Whisper video because I remember it when it happened. It was so ridiculous that it was in all the tabloids that the video had to be scrapped and his sister had to be flown in because he was unhappy with his hair. Correct. Now, again, I'm not having the best hair day, but, you know, you live with it. And but I also understand that if something is going to last the test of time and it's going to be out there for millions of people to see, you want it to be perfect. But how sad that somebody couldn't just focus on that voice and instead had to worry about. It's funny. He never seems to be worried about the voice. It's more the image. Because the voice would be there, except at the end, but we'll get to that.
One of the first big scores I had with this book in terms of interviews, because the first year of this book was really rough in terms of getting people to talk to me. And I was seriously worried about whether I would be able to gather what I needed to tell this story. And one of the first and easiest big scores was David Geffen. David Geffen knew George very well. And David was responsible for... my favorite George Michael album is Older, released in 1996. And David Geffen's newly co-founded record label, I believe his last record label, Endeavor, released it in the US and in Canada. It was a flop in this country. It was number one in the UK.
It was huge in England.
It was this gorgeous, melancholy, thoughtful, revealing album that George made. It broke his heart when it flopped in the U.S., but he was obsessed with being number one. Right until the end, he was personally wounded by the fact that he was no longer number one. One of the things that David Geffen said to me that really opened my eyes, he said, if you feel that bad about who you are, if you don't like yourself, if you hate the way you look, it doesn't matter how many millions of people are screaming for you. You're not going to believe them. You'll think that somehow they're lying to you or that you're a fraud. It doesn't matter how many people think you're hot. If you don't believe it, then you're going to probably wind up on the road that George Michael did.
You know, and yet, this need to be number one, you tell a great story in the book, which I didn't know. There were a lot of stories I didn't know. I don't want to make it like, oh, I know everything. I didn't know a lot. But the story about Last Christmas versus Do They Know It's Christmas was just, were those the two that were pitted against each other, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, exactly.
So he had released Last Christmas to be the Christmas single. And tell what happened with Do They Know It's Christmas? Because it's just such a fascinating story.
Oh, you know, why don't you tell it? Because the details, when you write a book like this, a whole book's worth of stuff is stuffed into your head. And then sometimes when I try to recount the stories that are in my own book, I have to look them up. But
no, this happens with so many people. But but what happened was is that Bob Geldof wanted him for Do They Know It's Christmas? And originally he didn't want to do it because he had his own Christmas single coming out. And Geldof was hoping this was going to be the Christmas number one, which is a huge deal in England. But George, two things. Number one, did want to be associated with a charity. But more importantly, number two, he knew the lineup of singers. And by omission, he would have been hugely absent. And people would have said, why isn't he involved? And he wanted to be involved, but he also knew by being involved, he might be screwing his own chances of being number one. And in fact, did.
Yes, but Last Christmas, of those two songs, I would say is the one that has endured. George, and while it was lovely of George and Andrew to give all the proceeds from that song away to charity, I thought, gee, that must have ended at a certain point, because can you imagine the amount of money that would come in from that song every Christmas? But apparently it's in perpetuity. Not that George needed the money. No, he laughed.
But it's a generous thing to do.
Oh, God. He must have foreseen the fact that that song would be so big. He had, for all the insecurities that he carried around, he had tremendous self-confidence in his talent and in his voice. That almost never left him, except one of the great sadnesses of George's later life is the fact that he essentially lost the ability to write songs, and his singing voice was, in, from all that I have seen and heard, severely impaired by the end of his life. And how could it not have been? Because he ingested so much smoke. He didn't take care of himself. He GHB was George's primary drug of choice in the last dozen years, but George also smoked crack cocaine. He was a cigarette smoker and a full-time pothead. And by the very end of George's life, based on the recording evidence that I've heard, his voice was a shadow of what it had been. And he knew.
Yeah, that's what I've heard as well. And again, it was just such a tragedy that that last tour did not make it to the U.S. Although the fact that he was able to resume it after that illness was staggering in itself.
That Symphonica tour, his last tour, as you say, was
such a great tour.
Beautiful show. And it got basically mixed to crummy reviews in the UK because critics were calling it boring and dull and slow moving and sad. But it was the mature statement that George had always wanted to make. He was so in his beautiful designer black suits, his gorgeous Armani and the salt and pepper hair. He looked like a distinguished elder statesman, and he was singing a lot of sad, slow songs that reflected exactly how he felt at the time. And that was a tremendously successful tour, except for the fact that in the middle of it, he nearly died of pneumonia.
Almost died. I mean, and that was, you know, he had been in the hospital for how long? In a coma?
A few weeks. Yeah. And he came out of it and he resumed the tour quite a few months later, but was not really well enough to complete all the canceled dates. He had to cut Australia off of the end of the tour, or chose to. He wasn't up to it. And then that was pretty much it. There were a few little small appearances that he made, but the public didn't see very much of George thereafter. And that is why that shock photo, that little grainy cell phone picture that you showed before, was so mortifying to people, because they didn't want to remember George
see
like
him
that
way. Right. It's like Brando at the end. You want to remember Brando from Streetcar, except Brando at the end was like in his 80s. George was still a relatively young man.
He was 53. But you know what? One of the loveliest things I discovered in the course of my research, anytime from the very beginning of this project, that I mentioned George Michael's name to people, if they asked, what are you doing now? I mentioned George and their faces all lit up. I mean, everybody that I mentioned George Michael to, and they all said, oh, I love George Michael. And that meant, and then they would recount how they first heard him or what their favorite song was or some memory of having seen him someplace that they never forgot. And I realized that he is not overall remembered as a tragic figure. He's no Billie Holiday. For all of the sadness and hardship and the premature demise, for some reason, all the happy stuff overrode all the sad stuff. And now when we think of George Michael, we feel good.
Well, I don't think that he... Like you brought up Whitney earlier. Whitney, we saw the demise happening before our very eyes. She was not careful. She was appearing in ways that she shouldn't have. Versus George, who for the most part was able to pull it together. Although, I didn't know this at all. That whole story about the Olympics.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God, in merciful heaven, that is the most tragic story I'd ever heard. I had to go back and find the footage to rewatch it. And while it doesn't appear quite as bad as it reads when you know what was going on and that he was forcing that other song on them and all, I mean, it was just a mess.
His last public appearance, that's true.
Was that it? Yeah. Oh, wow.
But, you know... In 1998, when George was arrested in the Beverly Hills men's room, which was a major blow to his American career, which already had diminished quite a bit since the early 90s. At the time, the gay establishment, the people who were fighting for gay men to be out loud and proud and to fling the closet doors open, were very unhappy with George because of the way he had chosen, I repeat, chosen, to behave and what came out of it. They felt that it gave gay people and the cause a bad name. But then decades pass. And I meet a lot of young gay people in places like Fire Island, and they know who George Michael is. And by the way, I was very happy in Bros to see that Freedom 90 is featured in a big disco scene. I thought that was super cool. But young gay people who know about George just see him as fabulous. They see him as triumphant. They don't know all the backstory that's in my book. They don't know how much he struggled with coming out, and they know videos of George in which he's this super macho, sexy, just hot. He was hot and big. He was a big, broad-shouldered guy, and they see him in these clips, and they know that he's gay, and to them, they just see him as an inspiration. Isn't that sweet?
Well, you know what it is... He did not have a role model. He didn't have a template. The closest he had was Elton John, who had done what so many people do, which is come out as bisexual when he married that Renata woman. And then, you know, oh, we were all looking, going, how long will this last? Days. What time is it? He's already divorced. And then, you know, but that was, you know, it was a different time. And I even know, while I was one of those people who was a little bit prodding in terms of why isn't he coming out? Let's get him out, blah, blah, blah. I now see, looking back, how fast things did change between Elton John's coming out and George's coming out. And while they were vastly different circumstances, George's coming out gave an entire generation the strength to come out because they saw he at least still had a career. It may not have been what it was for a variety of reasons, but he wasn't finished. And I think that was, and also he did, you can't say proud. He was not proud of being gay, but what he was at a certain point was unapologetic. And that, I think, was very strong. It was a very strong message then, and it's a very strong message now. And so for that, you have to give him some credit.
Oh, yeah. Who else in George's day was quite so outspoken about gay sex? If you were a goofy gay guy, if you were a clown-like gay guy like Elton was, then it wasn't perceived as threatening. But when you were on
Nobody was picturing Elton having sex with anybody, male or female. But people were picturing George having sex with people, and his videos were sexualized as well.
So if we knew or suspected that Paul Lynn was gay, that was okay, that was safe. But most people who are not kindly disposed toward gay people don't want to think about what gay people do in bed, or in George's case, in public parks and tea rooms. And here was George. Once the closet door was thrown open, he was pretty in your face about all of it. And that, I think, is very inspiring to young gay people who want to raise a middle finger at everybody who would seek to oppress them.
Yeah. And I think that he could have so easily did what he did at the time, explaining it, whatever, and then moved on and never referenced it again. But he incorporated it into his professional life, if nothing else. Maybe not completely into his personal life, but certainly his professional life.
Well, he knew that there was no escaping it, and he knew that every interviewer was going to bring it up. And so he did, he ran with it, but he became a Twitter junkie in his later years. And I read every single one of those tweets for purposes of my book. And there's a real angry edge to a lot of it, though. He never felt, it's like Elton John said after George died, he didn't feel that George had ever been that happy as a gay man. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of truth in that, because George didn't do a lot of this revelation with a sense of jubilance. He certainly did it with defiance. He did it with a lot of anger. He felt that he had been set up in that park in a kind of conspiracy between the British, the tabloids and the Beverly Hills Police Department, which I don't think is quite the case. But George, accountability was not George's middle name. And he... as honest as he was, I don't think George was a liar, but he had a very hard time fessing up to the role that he had played in the way things turned out for him. It's hard for a lot.
I think that's absolutely true. I think that's a good way of doing it, because again, taking that responsibility sort of would take the stinger out of that anger. And I think that was something that we said, it fueled him. And, you know, not as a victim necessarily, although he certainly did allude to that at times, but sort of as a champion of gay men who do this every day. And what's the big deal? And why are they targeting him for that reason?
I want to thank Kenny Morse, one of our viewers, for his lovely comments about the discussion we are now.
Okay, see, I'm not even seeing these. Okay, hold on. I'll pull it up. Insightful and beyond interesting is only Billy Masters Live does well. He's a dear friend. James' illumination of George Michael is extraordinary and fascinating. Thank you. Well, thank you. And we also heard from Carl, who is close with Mary Wilson and the Supremes, our good friend Carl, my good friend James. Well, Carl, you're my friend too, for God's sakes. Kenny also mentioned, let's not forget his duet with Elton, which is considered iconic, although it is a remake of a song, you know.
It is.
But it in many ways, it overshadowed the original.
There's a moment in that video that I absolutely love, in which they're there performing it on this big multi-level stage. And George, at a certain point, just catches fire. He has the songwriter next to him singing his own song. And George, at a certain point, just sings his heart out. And he is moving like a dream. And he breaks into this little dance step. And Elton is like this. And Elton does this little next to him. In response to what the fact that George, his friend and rival, has just run off with his song. I love it.
Yeah, you said an interesting thing in the book. I forget who you quoted, that saying that Elton really befriended George as he was coming up, which was apparently Elton's MO, but he never liked it when the people he befriended surpassed him. That then it became competitive.
Elton was very competitive as a rule, as his friend David Geffen shared very candidly with me. At one point in my book, I quote David Geffen as saying that if you were playing pool with Elton and you turned your head, he would move the ball. You can be his best friend, but he's not going to edit.
No. I don't want to give away too many details about my interview with you for the book. It's probably the most I've ever talked about George Michael. I mean, there's still some things that I would say for myself, but I guess in the timeline of you interviewing people, I was kind of near the beginning.
You were near the beginning, and your interview, I'll be grateful for it forever, because I was still figuring out who George was, and you shone a stronger, clearer light on the young George Michael than anybody had for me at that point. Your story, your moment with George, you know, you can interview people who knew somebody for 35 years and not get any insight out of them. And then you can interview somebody like yourself who had a moment with somebody, and it's like watching a movie unfold as you hear what's said. And that is what you gave to me. And your portrait of the young George Michael on that Wham tour in 1985, and what ensued when you met him by an absolute fluke is just so sweet. It showed me the sweetness of George Michael and the sweetness of you. And that's why you guys almost seemed destined to meet, if only for a heartbeat.
Yeah, it's funny when people have asked and they're like, oh, it's going to be a great scintillating sex story. What it is, you know, it's funny as I look back on it and, you know, it's sizzling and it has its moments, but it's a romantic evening. It was one of the most romantic evenings I've had, and which is so interesting because that's not what you would expect in somebody who is a pop star touring the world and, you know, is in Boston for a night and meets this guy for a night for what is going to be a hot sex night and becomes a romantic night. I don't think it's what he expected. It certainly wasn't what I expected.
But it says a lot about what was in George's heart. And only 3 years later, there he was on the Faith Tour, which was a phenomenally successful arena tour, world tour. And millions of girls were screaming for George in the course of that tour. And he felt more lonely than ever because he knew that the persona that he was giving them was a lie. It was a creation that he had whipped up in order to get where he got. And he felt like the fact that he had signed this contract with fame, the fine print of which said you have to keep your lip buttoned because if you tell the truth, it's all over. And your incident with George made me understand what he deep down inside wanted, but felt he could never have. And that is what he found with Anselmo. And that's what you see in that wonderful home movie footage. And when that was taken away from him, he was simply never the same after that.
Yeah, it's terribly sad when I read the book because I have an idea of what, you know, my experience was, which by the way was the last night of the Make It Big tour in the US, which also I've always wondered if it was because it was the last night that this happened. If this had been in the middle of the tour, would he have been in this situation that I found myself in? I don't know. Did you find other people that had either a one-night situation or any sort of fleeting encounter with him similar?
No. Similar, no. What I did find was, again, by a complete fluke, I interviewed someone who had met up with George in that same men's room in which he was arrested. That would have been, I guess, late March, early April of 1998, thereabouts, right before the big arrest had happened. And it's an interesting counterpoint to your lovely romantic story, because here's George, after Anselmo had died, after his mother had died, which absolutely tore him apart, now behaving in this reckless way, and in a toilet on a rainy day in Beverly Hills with nobody around, meeting up with this former school teacher whom I quote in my book, who was wonderfully candid with me about his little encounter with George Michael. So you have, you know, but when those two big losses took place, George could really no longer at that point face life unmedicated. First, he was a hothead, and then he moved on to the harder stuff. And at that point, all he was doing was trying to blot out his pain, I think. And he was in a relationship with this man named Kenny Goss, which was his longest term relationship. And I think that was romantic maybe for the first year or two, but they were both horn dogs and went their separate ways. And I wonder if George ever, it must have happened at some point, but the sweet romantic George that you met, I don't think lasted for very long. He had it again with Anselmo. That was 1991 to 93 when Anselmo died. And then after that, George's life was, he was dismantling George Michael as methodically as he had created George Michael. Huh. And he kept doing it until it permanently worked on Christmas Day.
Let me ask you about, I'm looking at the person's name, because it was really interesting, and I'm curious about him, James Sullivan.
Oh, yes.
Who he knew very young. He was a young American writer. Is that who he was?
He was a kind of backpacking student, and he was traveling Europe, found himself in London, and met the boys of The Executive, which was the little ska band that some of them had
right.
before Wham was born. And James Sullivan, who is a Facebook friend of mine, we met over Facebook, and he revealed to me that he had these very interesting, revealing moments of with George when before fame, when George was hell-bent on fame, but was obscure and struggling. And James witnessed a lot of interesting things that were not on public display. And that is one of my favorite interviews in my book.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of the George I met. So that's why it resonated with me. And again, maybe it was because it was young. But then going to the other side, let's talk about Fadi.
Ah, yes. Well, you're seeing
now,
it right
there. He looks happy, but that doesn't look like it's romantic. It looks like it's sex. That's what that's about. But I could be
Fadi
wrong.
Fadi, for a while there, was spectacular arm candy.
Yeah.
And they were together more or less in the last, I would say, 4 years of George's life.
Oh, that long. And okay.
Yeah, George kept trying to break away from it, but obviously he didn't, because Fadi was, as far as we know, the last person who saw George alive. Fadi was, by all descriptions that I've gathered, at the beginning at least, he was a talented stylist. He had his own career, and he had celebrity clients, but George encouraged him to give all of that up and just become George Michael's boyfriend. And so Fadi was living the high life from that point on. If you were George's other half, then you were in high cotton, because it meant the best of the most luxurious of everything, plus a monthly allowance that I could live on comfortably for 6 months or a year even, given the frugality of the way that I live, as you're seeing setting behind me. But Fadi was not bright, and a lot of people were very skeptical of Fadi, and it was hard to have a conversation with Fadi. Fadi was he was a former porn actor. I've only seen one scene. I'm told that there are others. I don't think he did it for very long, but he did do it. That was very titillating to George, especially because by that point, George was younger than I am now, but he was in his late 40s when he met Fadi, and he looked older than he was. And here was a porn actor, hottie, exactly George's type. George liked them swarthy and hairy, and Fadi was all of that. And so in the early phase of their relationship, George was tweeting all of these happy, sexy things about Fadi and how proud he was of Fadi, but that was not a relationship for the history books. I don't know what you could have a conversation with Fadi about. I never interviewed him, by the way. He made it pretty clear to the press that he wanted money in exchange for interviews.
Yeah.
And then after George died, there was extensive coverage of how Fadi had been essentially squatting in one of George's houses, which the family let him get away with until 2.5 years, I guess, had passed, and they finally found a way to get him out of there after he had completely trashed the house. He was pretty out of his mind. And the last reports of Fadi had had him wandering the streets of London homeless. But, you know, we do seek out the company that we know what we're doing when we choose our romantic partners, don't we? And if you're looking to self-destruct, you will find somebody who will aid you in your self-destruction, or who will encourage you, not block it.
You know, it was so sad to read all those details, and then the stuff about the funeral and everything else was just such a mess. Who is on the list? Because I know some of the people. Who is on the list of people that you really wanted to talk to, that wouldn't talk to? Because again, I suspect people didn't talk to you because they were closing ranks.
Yes. A lot of people had vested interests. They wanted to safeguard their own little piece of George that they had. And one of the people that I jumped through the most hoops in vain to get to was Elton John. I knew that if Elton John talked to me, that I would learn a lot about George that I wanted to know. In Elton's own memoir, there's very little of substance about George. I was surprised at how little there was, but I got ignored and I got ignored and I got ignored. And finally, a friend of Elton and David Furnish named Kieran Kowal, who a friend of mine who lives in Canada, he tried hard. He wrote a personal letter to David and pleaded my case and got a turned down. There was no way. I got no's from a lot of people. Boy, George, I don't think he ever really liked George. I certainly think he was jealous of George, but he didn't. And he had said his piece on George Michael. I understood. I tried so many ways into him. Rufus Wainwright blew me off.
That's interesting.
He barely knew. I guess he wanted Sauce to keep the story to himself. George sang one of his songs in the Symphonica tour, and I knew that there was a tiny story there to be told, but I never got it. I couldn't list lots
the of big people. Ones being Andrew, Shirley, and Pepsi, we talked about.
Yes.
I'm quoted Pepsi in the book Shirley, about that.
Who have since published their own book about the Wham! Which I confess I haven't read. It came out after my book was published. And Andrew, I didn't even try because he hates giving interviews. And I knew that he would not talk to me. A lot of these people that I approached a lot of people, and there were others that I was warned away from because people that I trusted said there is absolutely no way she can or will talk to you. The people who were in the will, for example, I don't think I got anybody who was in the will. That was an innermost circle. George. But as the book went on and doors started opening for me one after another, the more people I got, the more people I got. And I was realizing
through people you interviewed, like did people that you had been interview subjects then say, oh, I know somebody. Was it a lot of that?
Absolutely. People, if it went well with me, which as far as I know, it always did, people would then refer me to people and put themselves out on my behalf and make phone calls and send messages saying he's cool, you should talk to him. And then, you know, for this book, in addition to all those interviews, I found over 2,000 articles about George Michael. And believe me, that's a fraction of what's out there. And I would comb through the article looking for names. And then I would try and do my scavenger hunts and find these people on the internet. Sometimes they were responsive and many times they were not. But by the end of the book, I felt confident that I still feel that way, that I've gotten to the bottom of every major episode in George's life.
Well, it's an exhaustive book. It's over 500 pages. It's so detailed.
There's about the last 100 or so is all the index and due
notes. But I love notes. Oh my God. I live for notes. It's a fantastic book. I would suspect, this is just a hunch, that, you know, given in 10 years time or 15 years time, people will come out of the woodwork, you'll get more information, and I suspect you will do a revised edition at some point, because this is a story that will evolve. And I think when people see how balanced and fair and exhaustive it is, it's thoroughly researched and noted, that I think people will want to come out of the woodwork and want to add their part to his story.
You know, one close source, there are very few unnamed sources in my book. There are really only about three or four. But one of those sources said to me.
And who were they?
The unnamed sources. They're not celebrity unnamed sources. They're just
people. Oh, all right.
But no, nobody that would excite you. But they excited me, because if those people did talk to me pretty candidly. And one of them, after my book came out, said that he had heard from somebody who was way on the inside of the George Michael circle, told this source, and I quote, "It's the closest to the truth that anybody has ever gotten."
Yeah,
that's pretty good. That's not bad. I was very proud.
Especially for somebody who had gone to such lengths to create a little cocoon that they lived in. So I think that's extraordinary. And it speaks to your writing ability and your research. You are tenacious. How many years did you work on this book?
5 years from signing to publication.
Oh my God. What do you do? Oh. You know, can I just ask a personal question? How do you live for 5 years working on a book that's not paying enough to live on for 5 years? I mean, it's gotta be a labor of love. Nobody writes a book for money. Trust.
It's the story of my life. This is my fifth book, and it's always been that way. My advance for this was, frankly, less than I've gotten in a few books. This book was a hard sell. I thought it would be a no-brainer, easy sell.
And not only
did we only have one offer from this marvelous editor named David Cashion at Abrams, who fought my book through, but I had thought that everybody would want to write this book. And as far as I know, I'm the only one that was floating a proposal on it, which is very strange to me. And it tells you a little bit about how George Michael was perceived in the commercial marketplace in January of 2017 when I wrote that proposal. But how do I live? I'm a freelance writer. I do articles. I write. I'm a writer for hire. I do lectures sometimes. I squeeze out a living doing this. I got my advance money helped. I live frugally, of course. It's not an easy road, Billy, but it's the road that I chose. Things are getting better for me pretty much every year of my life. I've been at this for a long time, like you have. And I hope you can agree with me that things are better than ever for me now. And as hard as things have been, I can look back at many times in my life and think, how did I ever get through that? Times when I came so close to capsizing, and somehow through sheer desire, I managed to stay afloat. And now this reward has come my way, because this book has done better than anything I've ever done before.
Well, it says something to the quality of the book that 3 months later, certainly the British papers keep quoting it constantly. There are articles mentioning your book like every day, and in the States as well. I think it's really staggering. And, you know, it does shed a light on somebody who was so private that we all thought that we knew, and you realize a whole other side to him. So I applaud you. I'm going to remind people that the book is George Michael, A Life. Get it on Amazon. Where do you get the most money from them buying it? Do you get money from anybody? Like, should they buy it from Barnes & Noble? Do you get a kickback from anybody?
Oh, you know, my royalty rate is the same no matter which legitimate channel they purchase it through. So I guess Amazon is the best. Not that I want to pat Amazon on the back, but what would any of us do without it? That's where all of our books sell.
Exactly. But, so go to Amazon. So click. As a matter of fact, I will put a link on this video for you to just click through and buy it. Because, James, you're a great author. You've written, my favorite, I told you, is the Peggy Lee.
Thank you.
That's my favorite.
Yeah, I did Lena Horne and Chet Baker. They're all precious parts of my life. All of them took years to write. I don't turn them out fast. You and I have author friends. Incredibly prolific, and I'm just not. I get a story like George Michael is epic. It's about so many big things in life, and George's life, among other things, is an epic gay story. It's important for young gay people, whether they know it or not, to understand whose shoulders they stand on and how things were before we entered this marvelous period of enhanced freedom that we now live in. It didn't happen by itself. It happened because people like George Michael shed real blood in order to make it possible.
Absolutely. James, I love you. You know that. We're friendly.
I love you, Matt. Our meetings, as the song goes, our meetings are few and over too soon, and I hope we can fix that soon.
Oh, I hope so, too. James Gavin, thank you for being on Billy Masters Live. If you stay for a second, I'll talk to you when I close the show.
I loved every minute of it. Thank you, Billy.
Thank you, James. And everyone, thanks for watching Billy Masters Live. So next week, we are back because it is like the fall season. So we're back. Next week, we are having singers Nicholas King and Seth Sykes, who I'm sure James knows because, you know, he knows all these people. They're doing a tour called The New Belters, which of course is a little in joke with what Ethel Merman had said about Barbara Streisand, speaking of Barbara Streisand. So they will be on next week. So because I'm busy and they're busy, we might be pre-taping it like on Tuesday night or something. Now, I haven't told them this yet, but maybe when rather than it just being pre-taped, maybe we'll air it live on a Tuesday night. So it will be Billy Masters Live, and then we'll repeat it on Thursday for people who missed it. So I don't know exactly what's going to happen. So look, I'm always told that I don't say this. I think it's here. Where is it? There's a bell. There's a bell. Click on the bell. Click on the icon with my name and subscribe to our channel, and you'll know everything going on. Don't forget, go to billymasters.com every week. There's a fresh column every week, and God knows the column's not paying the bills. But if you read it more often, maybe it could. All right. Thank you very much for joining us for Billy Masters Live. I, of course, who else would I be but Billy Masters? And just remember, if we're here, we're live. Unless, of course, next week we might be pre-taped. But then if we're here, we're alive. Bye, guys. Take care.